her haunting female fear of being treated as a thing, an object of barter and desire and possession, would be set permanently at rest, and what she called her true self would soar upwards and expand in some freer and purer world. For she still thought that religion was a kind of exhalation or a cloud of incense, something steaming up from specially gifted souls towards a receptive heaven. Then quite sharply it occurred to her that the director never talked about religion, nor did the Dimbles, nor Camilla. They talked about God. They had no picture in their mind of some mist steaming upward, rather of strong, skillful hands thrust down to make and mend, perhaps even to destroy. Supposing one were a thing after all, a thing designed and invented by someone else, and valued for qualities quite different from what one had decided to regard as one's true self. Supposing all those people who, from the bachelor uncles down to Mark and Mother Dimble, had infuriatingly found her sweet and fresh, when she wanted them to find her also interesting and important, had all along been simply right and perceived the sort of thing she was. Supposing Maladil on this subject agreed with them and not with her. For one moment she had a ridiculous and scorching vision of a world in which God himself would never understand, never take her with full seriousness. Then at one particular corner of the gooseberry patch, the change came. What awaited her there was serious to the degree of sorrow and beyond. There was no form nor sound. The mold under the bushes, the moss on the path, and the little brick border were not visibly changed, but they were changed. A boundary had been crossed. She'd come into a world, or into a person, or into the presence of a person. Something expectant, patient, inexorable met her with no veil or protection between. In the closeness of that contact, she perceived at once that the director's words had been entirely misleading. This demand which now pressed upon her was not even by analogy like any other demand. It was the origin of all right demands and contained them. In its light, you could understand them, but from them, you could know nothing of it. There was nothing and never had been anything like this, and now there was nothing except this. Yet also everything had been like this, only by being like this had anything existed. In this height and depth and breadth, the little idea of herself, which she had hitherto called me, dropped down and vanished, unfluttering into bottomless distance like a bird in a space without air. The name me was the name of a being whose existence she had never suspected, a being that did not yet fully exist, but which was demanded. It was a person, not the person she had thought, yet also a thing, a made thing, made to please another, and in him to please all others. A thing being made at this very moment without its choice in a shape it had never dreamed of. And the making went on amidst a kind of splendor or sorrow or both, whereof she could not tell whether it was in the molding hands or in the kneaded lump. Words take too long. To be aware of all this and to know that it had already gone made one single experience. It was revealed only in its departure. The largest thing that had ever happened to her had apparently found room for itself in a moment of time too short to be called time at all. Her hand closed on nothing but a memory, and as it closed, without an instant's pause, the voices of those who have not joy, the voices of those who have not joy, rose howling and chattering from every corner of her being. Take care, drop back, keep your head, don't commit yourself, they said. And then more subtly, from another quarter, you've had a religious experience. This is very interesting. Not everyone does. How much better you will now understand the 17th century poets. Or from a third direction, more sweetly, go on, try to get it again. It will please the director. But her defenses had been captured and these counterattacks were unsuccessful. The sense of being made from above, born from above, as John puts it, born from above, what we call the new birth. This has nothing to do with religion, as all of these various authors vociferously state. It's not religion, it's a relationship with God that comes in the mystery of his gift of himself. And this is the way he describes it here. And these books all clarify this as you read them and delight you. And that's why there's nothing mushy or soggy or sentimental. There's the strength of God that rests over their language and shapes its beauty and gives you this scent that Paul calls the fragrance of the knowledge of God. For some, it is an odor of death unto death. There are those who can't take these books, can't take this kind of a confrontation. But for others, it's of life unto life. And in a wonderful way, these books have become part of the Christian proclamation to our century. You may want to talk a little bit before we gather our thoughts around the first of the books that some of you have read, and which we suggested is the first, simply because it's very readable, doesn't take too much discipline. The plot carries you on, and if you haven't read science novels much, its strangeness is not too great, and you can let yourself go and let yourself in on it without too great a strain to your imagination. Any book, you have to give yourself to the author, a kind of credulity is demanded of any reader, and this you do as you read these. And so you're there on the planet Mars as it's in the process of its death. But before we come to that, would you like to talk about anything that we have so far introduced? We don't want to be pushing you or rushing you. The delightful thing about the village, as the meditation library says, read slowly. We're not in any hurry to accomplish anything. Yes, for the first session? Is that what we said in that slip of paper? Thank you. I never remember anything I write, so that's good of you to say that.
Yeah.
No. Are the, have you got some more copies over there?
I've got some up in the house. I'll go and get them. You got them for sale, can't we?
Have you? I don't even have one copy here.
Well,
I had some.
Right there.
Well, here we have one. Have you read the Screwtape Letters recently? So you can tell them. I haven't read them since 1946.
No. The thing is, I think it'd just be fun if they, you know, if you let them
discuss.
Let a few people read around the way we usually do, and then see how it hits them.
Did you see the play that was based on it? We had it here at the village about 5 years ago. The Religious Drama Group put it on in Twin Cities. It's sort of a fun play, really. It's called Screwtape Letters, wasn't it? Did it? No, it did it. It was Terry Rowan, he acted in it.
What was the name of that play?
Based on Screwtape Letters.
Uncle Bob.
No, that isn't.
It's got another name, because they made it very much of a dramatic.
Oh, it was fun, and you could play, and the churches allowed them to show it in their chancels all over as the devil leaped all over the pulpit and the altar and everything else. It's, too bad Terry isn't here, because he'd know the name, but we'll get it from him. I didn't realize it had a different name. Well, as it says here, 500,000 copies have been sold of this book in the United States alone. So evidently it's very readable.
It's interesting, though, that C.S. Lewis didn't enjoy writing this.
Wormwood, Mary, was what it was called.
Yeah.
He really enjoyed writing this?
He didn't.
He didn't.
He didn't enjoy it.
No.
He really hated this thing, sorry. He didn't enjoy it like some of these others. And I don't think he especially enjoyed, and this was disturbing, you know, the Narnia series. And this is one of the things that will certainly live longer than most.
And he didn't particularly enjoy them, he just had to write them. Because he wasn't particularly happy with children.
That's
as you
right.
said, he didn't like children particularly.
How do you know this?
Pardon?
Well, he says it himself.
Yeah, he said it. He liked the company of men. I mean, real men.
Yeah.
And he fell very much in love with the with this lady.
Well, Joy Davidman.
Why don't you tell us something about...
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I thought that, well, I can tell you a good deal about him, but I thought some other time, maybe near the end. I think it's better, you know, to kind of look at what he wrote, you know. Hong taught me this, the great senior professor of philosophy at Holden Village, Hong. I mean, he got me out of this habit because, you know, as a scientist, you're always giving evidence. I mean, who said it? I mean, you learn all the names of the people, and whenever you read an article, you figure out who wrote it, you know? I mean, you know? But in Hong's business, I mean, he says, what does it say, you know? And so we should look at what he says, and maybe Monday morning, I'll tell you my views on the fellow, and I'll give you some, the light on C.S. Lewis by these authors, you know. I've underlined some things that will sort of describe the man to you. And since I had a letter from him, I'll tell you what I think I'm from there.
If he didn't enjoy writing these things, like Screwtape Letters, do you believe what he wrote?
Yes, this I can read you here. The proper question is whether I believe in devils. I do. That is to say, I believe in angels, and I believe that some of these, by the views of their free will, have become enemies to God, and as a corollary to us. These we may call devils. They do not differ in nature from good angels, but their nature is depraved. Devil is the opposite of angel, only as bad man is the opposite of good man. Satan, the leader or dictator of devils, is the opposite, not of God, but of Michael. I believe that this not in the sense is part of my creed, but in the sense it is one of my opinions. My religion would not be in ruins if this opinion were shown to be false. Till that happens and proofs of a negative are hard to come by, I shall retain it. It seems to me to explain a good many facts. It agrees with the plain sense of Scripture, the tradition of Christendom, and the beliefs of most men at most times. And it conflicts with nothing that any of the sciences has shown to me. Which might be of interest to you, I was just trying to think of this rather famous philosopher that has been converted to Christianity. He didn't believe in God, but he believed in the devils. and following this up, as he believed in evil, but he couldn't believe in goodness, he was finally converted. And I think this is true, that a natural philosophy can lead you to the existence of evil and even personal evil in the sense of demonic. And you'll notice the word demonic occurs frequently in our literature today. I mean, you run into that much more often than you run into the word divine. I don't know of any historians that use the word divine, but I don't know of any historians that don't use the word demonic, to give you an idea of how frequent it is. In the church as a whole? Well, I think for all of us who read and who delight in the exchange of fantasy and thought and conversation, that we love it and are very much with it. For those for whom it's a religion and something heavy and who are under law, they don't even know what to say. I mean, it fits Holy Village because the kind of people who come here are the kind of respond to this. But the kind of people who'd be really uneasy and offended in the village are those who are uneasy and offended by C.S. Lewis and company too.
I'd say much of organized religion would regard the demonic as sort of old-fashioned.
That's right.
Is the trend toward this because of what's happening in the world?
Yeah.
Is it perhaps?
Of course, you see the demonic in our society, in our so-called neo-orthodoxy, makes quite a good deal of use of this word demonic. So in that section of theology, it's a very real thing. And the demonic here, like for instance in all of one of, I suppose, America's outstanding theologians in the 20th century is Reinhold Niebuhr. And he makes a great deal of use of it in the sense that it's, when good is at its best, that it's most dangerous and becomes most perverse. And this is what he calls the demonic. The fact that nothing can be as frustrating as a faculty meeting for being stupid and unintelligent. You know, it's just when you get the most intelligent men together, it can be something that's most dull and dreary. And decisions can be quite perverse and inhumane, even. And this sense of the demonic that we all know. I usually use for an illustration for my conference, this illustration I used this week, Thursday, with you people, that certainly none of us really believes that either the Russians or ourselves desire an atomic Holocaust. But at the same time, unfortunately, all of us in our sober moments don't believe that we're going to escape that kind of a trial. And this is the demonic, that which our own better judgment tells us is stupid and perverse and destructive, and yet we fall into it. And this is what the historians usually use by the thought of demonic. The fact that man learns nothing from history. That all man learns from history is that he learns nothing from history, the way Hegel put it. That he seems to be incapable of learning from his own mistakes. Historics, as a group. You take what we're doing in Vietnam, I think comes under that category. I mean, everything in this is contrary to our own tradition. Well, I was in the United Nations when the big argument was over Algiers. We backed the French in Algiers, you know. But it was when all the independent nations voted a censure against them, and the French walked out of the United Nations at Nevada that afternoon. I can remember the sad, sorry arguments of a country like ours, which is a child of revolution, you know, had in simply backing the dominant powers, France and England at this moment in their colonial policy. And so, frustrated and angered and alienated all the emerging nations in order to sort of maintain some kind of an uneasy NATO front, which France later broke anyway. This comes under this sort of demand, as far as the historians use the term. I love this little book I had at the noon prayer meeting, and I should have taken it with me since the discussion moves this way a little bit. It's a very excellent book on it. It's not long. It's by one of the fine thinkers who would have been here next summer. I invited him for next summer, but next summer he's president of the English Methodist Church and couldn't come. He's a professor, E. Gordon Rupp, and it's called Principalities and Powers. And it's a delightful book on this whole subject. And he has one comment in there. It's almost unforgettable. No one has a right to complain about being a victim of history before he has confessed himself as its villain. You know, kind of a good little insight. I'll bring it and read some of it because it is good. Incidentally, he is the one who sprang to Luther's defense in wartime when even the Archbishop of Canterbury, William Temple, went along with Lord Vansittart and the attack upon Luther as being the father, the spiritual father of Hitler. And that's when he wrote this fascinating book on Luther's theology called The Righteousness of God. Incidentally, the Screwtape Letters, as you notice, has as its front of its piece a quote from Luther, I believe, isn't it? As far as I can remember from way back when, because I wrote him and said he was sort of a 20th century Luther, and this he was. Yeah, the best way to drive out the devil, if he will not yield to texts of scripture, is to jeer and flout him, for he cannot bear scorn. And you know, Luther always says, Sir Satan. He's very, very polite and ironic. Plato, you know. Always call him Sir Satan. And then nice, you know, that he takes as nice. Luther says, the nice people are Satan's saints. And how he weeps when one of them falls into some open sin of drunkenness or adultery. For his power is in keeping his nice people, you know, nice. And the sense of the attack upon the religious as a concept, as a cultural concept, rather than under the category of religion, of course, stems from Luther. And in the Ladies' Home Journal, when it had a delightful analysis of the religious situation in America back in about 1951, I think it was, Niebuhr was the Protestant on that, and Father Ford from Columbia, and then they had a Jewish thinker, I don't remember who, but they used Luther again to sum that up, in which they said, you can see by this, they sent out 20 to 20,000 people questionnaires, or they got back information from 20,000 people, I don't know how many they sent. And I remember one of the figures, 95% of the people who go to church believe that people kept the golden rule, everything would be all right. And 95% of the people who go to church believe they keep the golden rule. Only 5% in the statistics of Protestants, Jews, and Catholics went to church because they were sinners in need of grace. And they summed it up then with a quote from Luther, that this proves that religion is man's last and best escape from God. And it's in this spirit that all this literature really sharpens and opens our minds. Readers are advised to remember that the devil is a liar. Not everything the Screwtape says should be assumed to be true even from his own angle. I've made no attempt to identify any of the human beings mentioned in the letters, but I think it very unlikely that the portraits, say, of Father Spike or the patient's mother are wholly just. There's wishful thinking in hell as well as on earth. Have you seen Bedazzled, the movie, Bedazzled? Well, here is really a movie that's in the C.S. Lewis tradition. In fact, it's based, you might say, on one little comment that's in here that the devil, I think it's in this book, the devil has never created anything. He can only ruin the pleasures. No, you never create, but you only ruin them. And this is what the theme of Bedazzled is. And it's a delight. You should see it. Now, it's interesting that all the movie critics in Minneapolis thought this an irreverent film. And so I thought, well, why bother to go? Incidentally, the movie critics in Minneapolis papers happened to be Jewish. And they said they were offended by it. And this was an irreverent picture, an anti-religious movie. And I was lecturing a series of 5 lectures on contemporary theologies, and I happened to have these English lay theology for that particular Sunday. And 2 of the women came up and said, "My, you've got to go see this movie. This is the closest Christian film we've seen, and it's just like it was based on your lecture for today." So I did. I went out and saw it that very evening with my son Paul. Weren't too many in the movie theater because I think the critics had scared them out. There's no use in the city of Billy Graham and the American Lutheran Church in sponsoring blasphemous films, you know. And it was hilarious. It was hilarious. And then when he introduces this fellow that he's duped into these 7 wishes for his soul, in exchange for his soul, and when he introduces them to his servants, when Paul and I were there that Sunday evening, nobody laughed because nobody knew the scriptures enough to laugh. He says, "Lousy servants, but it's the wages they get." You know? Sloth and vice, you know, and vanity and lust and so on. But a wonderful film and a wonderful ending. A very much C.S. Lewis film and a C.S. Lewis ending.
An American?
It's put out by 2 English guys who both wrote it and acted in it. And it's just as fresh as one of these. And she's awful.
And
she's no good acting.
About once or twice, you might wish she'd heard more. But this is what always irritates her. Same thing happens.
And there's no lust in those scenes.
No. I'm glad you told me because then my wife will let me go.
I thought I should give you a chance.
Well, you do want to see it because it is simply a delightful spoof and one of the few good comedies. I mean, it's a comedy that for me ranks as comedy with 1,000 Clowns. It's a really good comedy. Well, anyway, I just want to mention that because it's in the C.S. Lewis tradition of that movie itself. Well, do you have some more comments you want to get at before we get into this?
Could you give some more examples of this business of a revival of language preceding revival?
Yes, certainly it's true for the Reformation. And since, yes, whenever people become concerned once more about the actual sense of words, they become caught by the meaning of, for instance, a word like repentance, which is one of the big arguments within the religious groups in our day. Repentance is a very weak, ambivalent kind of a term that can easily become egocentric. As a consequence, it never occurs in the Joanine literature. He never even uses it. And the minute you start to become sensitive language, you see. Because the first thing a guy has to do is repent of his repentance. And this is a little difficult to get across. There's nobody harder boiled or more difficult for the average pastor than the guy who knows he's okay because he had a conversion back so-and-so, you know. And it's a demonic thing in his life. And we all know guys like this that have kept many people from Jesus Christ, actually, you know. And this is a very difficult word to deal with. And just that one word. But when it means what it means in the Greek, then it has to become a new person, a new being, a new creation, and continually anew. And this is true in the whole 20th century renewal of theology, the sensitivity. Like, incidentally, it came out of literature. Karl Barth, for instance, says he learned more from Dostoevsky and Sigurd Undset than he did from all the theologians. Because they're concrete, they're particular, they're not... The difficulty with all 19th century theology and why it got into sentimentality and actually completely irrelevancy was because it was abstracting. It was always abstracting. It was trying to systematize by abstracting instead of making real by concretizing what the scripture says. One book on prayer that was a shock to the 19th century, the man who wrote it, one of the great theologians, however, on Das Gebet als Fürbitte, prayer is specific request. Laughable. Oh, we had one theologian here this summer. It wasn't Cooper. It was another one who said, after all, prayer was, as request was out, it was a form of idolatry. It was trying to make yourself God. God knew everything. Okay. This isn't scriptural. It's Immanuel Kant. Okay. And then you lose this vividness of the word and the relationship to the word. And it's been one of the fun things about, look at all of our translations of the New Testament that have just been coming into every church. The Jerusalem Bible for the Roman Catholic now, the New English, for us the first one done by committee since the King James, and the sense of language once more, the sense of our own language. The recovery of a poet like Gerard Manley Hopkins out of the 19th century almost got passed by but it was actually a recovery of the original strength and masculine vigor of the Anglo-Saxon poet. And some of these things, it's all concurrent. T.S. Eliot, W.H. Auden, all of this. It's no, it isn't just an accident that John Berryman, who happens to be the most honored poet at the University of Minnesota, has one of the most popular courses there, History of Western Civilization, in which the first lecture begins with your first assignment is to read Mark, and is to read it from within, to read it as Mark wrote it, the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, because you can't understand unless you read it within his terms and his own understanding. And then, of course, the Jewish students, who make up about 30-40% of the class, they're once a furor, how can we do that? And he says, that's your problem, not mine. Because this is what Mark wrote. And then he goes on in the same lecture to say, and he says, we'll discover in this particular course that the central figure of Western civilization is Martin Luther. His tragedy was that he fell into the hands of the Lutherans. But he's still a central figure of Western civilization. And which is, it's the sense of the word and the significance of the word and its communication is what's central to our civilization, isn't it? And once more, we become excited about words and what they mean. Then we come alive. You notice how easily we become sleepy and duped as words are repeated. This is a secret of propaganda, isn't it? And how with our Vietnam War, what is the word that they've been using so often with that? Pacification.
Peace with justice.
You know what?
Peace with justice.
Peace with justice and pacification and so on. All to be done with what? Bullets.
Bullets, yeah.
Yeah. Bullets and bombs. This is the abuse of language, you see. When we become duped by it, everything becomes upside down. We can't think anymore. And like Life magazine said about McCarthy, that this was the freshness of his appearance on the American scene. That once more language was being used for reflection. And it was being assumed that because you were human, you could reflect. And he refused to become propagandizing, but simply demanding reflection. Remember, Life didn't say it was for him, but they said this was the refreshing thing that happened in the political scene again. And no question about this is what made the young adult world respond to him like it did.
It would be a good idea, I think, if George Orwell's 1984, that one chapter on no speak, you know, that I referred to before, in the way he actually changed language, the meaning of words, if that could be made into a tract and put in church, in church tract shelves, because this is what happens to us in the church. We finally become no-speak. We aren't using words. They no longer have the meaning that they're in.
Take one other word, and that's the word love. And the minute you start to deal with this, what happens, you see? And you're not allowed to just retain its animality. You have to see what is involved here, and that it's more simply than kinship and friendship of one for another. And finally, as you study the word, you're driven into the understanding of it as the scripture uses it, that which creates in the object, that which loves that which is unlovable so that it becomes lovable, you see.
What about the
gives what it demands.
What about the use of Father King? Like to use agape, A-G-A-P-E, for
yeah.
love?
Yeah.
Which would give you an entirely different connotation.
Right, Mr. Small, exactly.
The old word love applies to so many different ideas. Agape doesn't.
No, this is right. And this is what I'm just saying. That's what you finally see. Agape is the love for the loveless. He'll come into it quite often. And it's quite an interesting one that one is also there. Three words you usually hear about are the love that is simply eros, a love of sex and that is the sexual side of it, and simply that. Then the love that is philia, the love of intellect and of person to person, of friendship, and then this divine agape. But there also is this storgeo, and that's the affectionate level, the warmth of the physical, the animality as such. It doesn't necessarily need to be right. There's a love of pets and a love of family and so on. And he says, in the last times, men will be without natural affection. It will be a storgeo. that there will be this phenomenon, which I believe is true in our times, but I don't want to introduce that debate tonight, that there are parents who don't love their children. They just beget them. They bring them up. There's a pride in them. They should reflect their investment in them. But an actual giving of themselves to them, which is love, doesn't happen. And so people are without this natural affection and haven't been warmed by it. And we get a number of these people who've been literally crippled in our Holden Village Fellowship amongst our young adults. And they need a lot of love. This is all they need.
That's like your chimps.
Growing up with those wire-frame honey. Yeah, without the money. Dad, I didn't hear that. She's recalling my lecture on the subhuman, on the life, well, the subhuman primates, you know. Those that are raised in a deprived environment or raised without their mother, you know. You can do this in a lot of species. You can even do it in sheep, and with sheep, you know, there's no question who belongs inside the tent, who belongs outside the tent, you know. I mean, they weren't really born bright. Boy, they need a mother, huh?
So that poor little baby trying to get nursed from its mother, and she just kept knocking her. She didn't know how to treat it.
Yeah.
She'd never been raised.
They raise them, they take them up to motherhood, and then they don't know how to raise their own children. Maybe it has something to say to us.
I wish I had my Barth library here. I don't. I leave it at home. I only have one of the books here. But Barth is the most famous of all 20th century thinkers in this whole subject of Satan. I mean, at a profound philosophical level. And for him, he calls Satan simply non-being. He is das Nichtige, the nothing. And this nothing, however, has an action, you see. It has an interaction. But it has not the capacity of existence in itself. And it's a very profound essay and well worth looking at through any of you, because it's coming into English now, and you'll be able to read it yourself. And scripture is not in any sense a strict dualism. There is a kind of dualism, but it's not a strict one. It's not a metaphysical one. The contest of good and evil is not with each one opposed with equal force by any means. It's sort of a kind of matter and antimatter idea here that is behind this thinking. And he says this right away. He says, there are two equal and opposite errors into which our race can fall about the devils. One is to disbelieve in their existence, the other is to believe and to feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them. They themselves are equally pleased by both errors, and hail a materialist or a magician with the same delight. The sort of script which is used in this book can be very easily obtained by anyone who has once learned the knack, but ill-disposed or excitable people who might make a bad use of it shall not learn it from me. Readers are advised to remember that the devil's a liar, and so on, and he goes on with that. The way in which the continental thinking and literature and theology as well have dealt with this area is in terms of the lie. And you run into this a great deal in its thinking, the lie, the father of lies, and that men are in the lie. And that is why the truth cannot be perceived by them. They prefer the darkness because their deeds are evil, as John says, they won't come into the light lest they be reproved. And the sense of walking in the lie, in one of the fascinating novels, and well worth your time to read, and sheer poetry, it's a beautiful novel, I think the best one written by any Lutheran novelist in our century. And that's The Liar, by Martin A. Hansen. He's a man who died about 44 years old when he died, a very fine poet and a gifted writer. And The Liar is in English, and you can get it in most public libraries, and it's a beautiful thing. It's about a teacher. And what he's written here is to just show the text in that, I think, third Sunday in Lent, where one devil is cast out and seven more come, and the last state is worse than the first. And the point he makes in the novel, a very beautifully done novel, and you just enjoy it throughout. He's a teacher on a lonely island where he also has to sub as the preacher on Sunday. There aren't many people on the island, and this is as spring is coming. And the breakup of winter and the contact with the mainland again. But as he's on this little Danish island in this Danish archipelago, and responsible in a sense for these souls,
He's not really involved, even in his own life. He's a spectator to his own life, devoted to his teaching. He gets up at 5 o'clock in the morning to think of new gimmicks for his kids every day. Comes to class with another one, you know, and so on. And this is his journal. But in it, the Ryan's journal is a self-discovery that he's never been committed, that he's an uncommitted person. And the point that the novel makes is that the Lutheran concept, culturally, of vocation, is that it's enough for a man to give himself to his vocation, but the last state is worse than the first. He has to have given himself to the one who makes his life personal and interpersonal. And despite his sort of literary enjoyment of these people, he hasn't given himself to them. In fact, he remains a bachelor. He doesn't even dare give himself to one. Now, it's a good book, and I didn't mention it, because it's in the same context from our own Lutheran setting. It's one of the good ones, and it does happen to have been translated in a good translation. And it's sheer poetry. The Liar by Martin A. Hansen. Well, we'll just go into this a little bit now and see it. The style will delight us. My dear Wormwood, I note what you say about guiding your patient's reading and taking care of that he sees a good deal of his materialist friend. But are you not being a trifle naive? It sounds like you suppose that argument was the way to keep him out of the enemy's clutches. That might have been so if he lived a few centuries earlier. At that time, the humans still knew pretty well when a thing was proved and when it was not. And if it was proved, they really believed it. They still connected thinking with doing and were prepared to alter their way of life as a result of a chain of reasoning. But what with the weekly press and other such weapons, we have largely altered that. And here is his attack that comes all the way through on journalism, which is one with Kierkegaard. And this is the Kierkegaard he noted, and I suspect they had read some Kierkegaard. And Kierkegaard says that if he ever had a son, that he could wish the greatest ill on him, he would wish that he might someday grow up and be a journalist. And for him, the root of the lie was journalism. Because journalism is not concerned with truth, but with simply impact. But what the weekly press and other such weapons, we've largely altered that. Your man has been accustomed ever since he was a boy to having a dozen incompatible philosophies dancing about together in his head. He doesn't think of doctrines as primarily true or false, but as academic or practical, outworn or contemporary, conventional or ruthless. Jargon, not argument, is your best ally in keeping him from the church. Don't waste time trying to make him think that materialism is true. Make him think it is strong or stark or courageous, that it is the philosophy of the future. That's the sort of thing he cares about.
We should say here that, I mean, it's the chief devil writing to his subaltern on how to compromise the soul.
How are you going to actually win him and snare him? And you see here the thing is not to let him actually test these words to see what they mean, but to use them in an emotional way to appeal to his masculinity and to a sense of wanting to be with it, with the inner group, with the inner circle, see, with a progressive element, as he continually brings out.
Yeah.
Yes?
Isn't that kind of
Ayn Rand? Sure it is. This is her appeal to the youth. This is her thought, the ruthless individualist, this sickening socialism that's been part of our time and so on. Ayn Rand's, you know, her novels, which are very good novels. And Atlas Shrugged and so on. And it's very disturbing and yet appealing to many young adults. And Hitler, of course, used this in his appeal to the young adult. None of this sickening Christianity with its meekness. The strong shall win, you know. This emotive approach. Now, it's very interesting, and this is a conviction Luther has also. The truth will win. That the free truth will win. This is why there are no strictures in our church about this or any worry about it. His complete naive kind of confidence. The truth, if permitted freedom, will ultimately win. Now, despite what they say about man, they still believe in his possibility of this kind of responsiveness to truth. And it is, as we know, looking at our history these 400 years, a bit on the naive side, and yet this truth, the truth is still around. The trouble about argument is that it moves the whole struggle onto the enemy's own ground. He can argue too. Whereas in really practical propaganda of the kind I am suggesting, he has been shown for centuries to be greatly the inferior of our father below. Well, you have but just to think of what's one of the most popular little slogans of the contemporary theology. It's from Bonhoeffer. I can't think of anything less appealing. When Jesus Christ calls a man to follow him, he calls a man to die. Oh, and the devil, what's he offering? No. Life, leisure, forget that stuff. That's for the old fogies. By the very act of arguing, you awake the patient's reason. And once it is awake, who can foresee the result? Even if a particular train of thought can be twisted so as to end in our favor, you will find that you've been strengthening your patient the fatal habit of attending to universal issues and withdrawing his attention from the stream of immediate sense experiences. Remember a fellow I went out to visit CCC camps with one summer. We spent one day in each one, and he was an all-American athlete who was always in church on Sunday morning. And so that's why he was with me, and he gave a little character to something or another each time. No sense of what Christianity was all about, but a nice guy. Great, big, huge tackle that really hardly moved his shoulders, and three guys would be on the ground. You know, fantastic, all-American tackle. And my little talks, he took 20 minutes, and I took 7. And these were command performances, and all these boys in the CCC camps had to come. And, of course, mine were specifically down the line. And it was getting to him. And one night he says, you know, he says, I'm in trouble. I got to talk. No, if I do, I won't sleep. So the immediate sense experience, that's the thing. Your business is to fix his attention on the stream. Teach him to call it real life, and don't let him ask what he means by real. Remember, he is not like you, a pure spirit, never having been a human. Oh, that abominable advantage of the enemies. You don't realize how enslaved they are to the pressure of the ordinary. I once had a patient, a sound atheist, used to read in the British Museum. One day as he sat reading, I saw a train of thought in his mind beginning to go the wrong way. The enemy, of course, was at his elbow in a moment. Before I knew where I was, I saw my 20 years' work beginning to totter. If I had lost my head, begun to attempt a defense by argument, I should have been undone. But I was not such a fool. I struck instantly at the part of the man which I had best under my control and suggested that it was just about time he had some lunch. The enemy presumably made the counter-suggestion. You know how one can never quite overhear what he says to them. That this was more important than lunch. At least I think that must have been his line. For when I said quite, in fact, much too important to tackle at the end of a morning, the patient brightened up considerably, and by that time I had added, much better come back after lunch and go into it with a fresh mind. He was already halfway to the door. Once he was in the street, the battle was won. I showed him a newsboy shouting the midday paper and a number 73 bus going past, and before he reached the bottom of the steps, I had gotten him into an unalterable conviction that whatever odd ideas might come into man's head when he was shut up alone with his books, a healthy dose of real life, by which he meant the bus and the newsboy, was enough to show him that all that sort of thing just couldn't be true. He knew he'd had a narrow escape. In later years, he was fond of talking about that inarticulate sense for actuality, which is the ultimate safeguard against the aberrations of mere logic. He is now safe in our Father's house. You going to see the point? Thanks to processes which he set at work in them centuries ago, they find it all but impossible to believe in the unfamiliar while the familiar is before their eyes. Keep pressing home on him the ordinariness of things. Above all, do not attempt to use science, I mean real science, as a defense against Christianity. They will positively encourage him to think about realities he can't touch and see. There have been sad cases among the modern physicists. If he must dabble in science, keep him on economics and sociology. Or psychology, I would say. Don't let him get away from that invaluable real life. But the best of all is to let him read no science, but to give him a grand general idea. Then he knows it all, and that everything he happens to have picked up in casual talk and reading is the results of modern investigation. Do you remember you are there to fuddle him? Do remember you are there to fuddle him. From the way some of you young fiends talk, anybody would suppose it was our job to teach. Your affectionate Uncle Screwtape. Okay, now we'll go on here with Wormwood. Somebody want to read? Leo over there? Can you see? Is the light good enough?
That's the question. I'll see if I can.
I'm under a good light.
Number 2. Oh, I got my glasses on. I think I can see you. My dear Wormwood, I note with grave displeasure that your patient has become a Christian. Do not indulge the hope that you will escape the usual penalties. Indeed, in your better moments, I trust you would hardly even wish to do so.
In the meantime, we must make the best of the situation. There is no need to despair. Hundreds of these adult converts have been reclaimed after a brief sojourn in the enemy's camp and are now with us. All the habits of the patient, both mental and bodily, are still in our favor. One of our great allies at the present is the church itself. Do not misunderstand me. I do not mean the church as we see her spread out through all time and space and rooted in eternity, terrible as an army with banners. That, I confess, is a spectacle which makes our boldest tempters uneasy. But fortunately, it is quite invisible to these humans. All your patient sees is the half-finished sham Gothic erection on the new building estate. When he goes inside, he sees the local grocer with a rather oily expression on his face bustling up to offer him one shiny little book containing a liturgy which neither of them understand, and one shabby little book containing corrupt text of a number of religious lyrics, mostly bad, and in very small print. C.S. Lewis, he gets wheeled off on the hymn. He addresses this in a book for a recent publication. When he gets to his pew and looks around him, he sees just that selection of his neighbors whom he has hitherto avoided. One will lean pretty heavily on his neighbors, make his mind flip to and fro between an expression of the body of Christ and the actual faces in the next pew. It matters very little, of course, what kind of people that next pew really contains. You may know one of them to be a very great warrior on the enemy's side. No matter. Your patient, thanks to our Father below, is a fool. Provided that any of those neighbors sing out of tune, or have the boots that squeak, or double chins, or odd clothes, the patient will quite easily believe that their religion must therefore be somewhat ridiculous. At this present stage, you see, he has an idea of this in his mind, which he supposes to be spiritual, but which in fact is largely pictorial. His mind is full of togas and sandals and armor and bare legs, and the mere fact that the other people in the church wear modern clothes is a real, though of course an unconscious, difficulty to him. Never let it come to the surface. Never let him ask what he expected them to look like. Keep everything hazy in his mind now. You will have all eternity wherein to amuse yourself by producing in him the peculiar kind of clarity which hell affords. Work hard then on the disappointment or anticlimax, which is certainly coming to the patient during his first few weeks as a churchman. The enemy allows this disappointment to occur on the threshold of every human endeavor. It occurs with a boy who's been enchanted in the nursery, or the stories from the Odyssey, buckles down to really learning Greek. It occurs when lovers have got married and begin the real task of learning to live together. In every department of life, it marks the transition from dreaming aspiration to laborious doing. The enemy takes this risk because he has a curious fantasy of making all these disgusting little human vermin into what he calls his free lovers and servants. Sons is the word. He uses with his inveterate love of degrading the whole spiritual world by unnatural liaisons with the two-legged animals. Desiring their freedom, he therefore refuses to carry them by their mere affections and habits to any of the goals which he sets before them. He leaves them to do it on their own, and there lies our opportunity. But also remember, there lies our danger. If once they get through this initial dryness successfully, they become much less dependent on emotion, and therefore much harder to tempt. I have been writing hitherto on the assumption that the people in the next pew afford no rational ground for disappointment. Of course, if they do, if the patient knows that the woman with the absurd hat is a fanatical bridge player, or the man with the squeaky boots a miser and an extortioner, then your task is so much the easier. All you then have to do is to keep out of his mind the question, if I, being what I am, can consider that I am in some sense a Christian, why should the different vices of those people in the next pew prove that their religion is mere hypocrisy and convention? You may ask whether it is possible to keep such an obvious thought from occurring even to a human mind. It is, Wormwood, it is. Handle him properly, and it simply won't come into his head. He has not been anything like long enough with the enemy to have any real humility yet.
What he says, even on his knees, about his own sinfulness is all parrot talk. At bottom, he still believes he has run up a very favorable credit balance in the enemy's ledger by allowing himself to be converted, and thinks he is showing great humility and condescension in going to church with these smug, commonplace neighbors at all. Keep him in that state of mind as long as you can. Your affectionate uncle.
Now you can see the note here of having to be converted from our conversions. It's a very clear one immediately.
Not every day.
Yep, that's right. And this, you see, language again, and the meaning of forgiveness. Well, somebody else got good light with a book that wants to read the next third chapter back there anywhere? From the other side?
My dear Wormwood, I'm very pleased by what you tell me about this man's relation to his mother. But you must press your advantage. The enemy will be working from the center outward, gradually bringing more and more of the patient's conduct under the new standard, and may reach his behavior to the old lady at any moment. You want to get in first. Keep in close touch with our colleague, who is in charge of the mother, and build up between you in that house a good settled habit of mutual annoyance, daily pinpricks. The following methods are useful. Keep his mind on the inner life. He thinks his conversion is something inside him, and his attention is therefore chiefly turned at present to the states of his own mind, or rather to that very expurgated version of them, which is all you should allow him to see. Encourage this. Keep his mind off the most elementary duties by directing it to the most advanced and spiritual ones. Aggravate the most useful human characteristics, the horror and neglect of the obvious. You must bring him to a condition in which he can practice self-examination for an hour without discovering any of those facts about himself which are perfectly clear to anyone who has ever lived in the same house with him or worked in the same office.
Yes.
Two, no doubt impossible to prevent his praying for his mother, but we have means of rendering the prayers innocuous. Make sure that they are always very spiritual, that he is always concerned with the state of her soul and never with her rheumatism. Two advantages will follow. In the first place, his attention will be kept on what he regards as her sins, by which, with a little guidance from you, he can be introduced to mean any of her actions which are inconvenient or irritating to himself. Thus you can keep rubbing the wounds of the day a little sore while he is on his knees. The operation is not at all difficult, and you will find it very entertaining. In the second place, since his ideas about her soul will be very crude and often erroneous, he will, in some degree, be praying for an imaginary person. And it will be your task to make that imaginary person daily less and less like the real mother, the sharp-tongued old lady at the breakfast table. In time, you may get the cleavage so wide that no thought or feeling from his prayers for the imagined mother will ever flow over into his treatment of the real one. I've had patients of my own so well in hand that they could be turned at a moment's notice from impassioned prayer for a wife's or a son's soul to beating or insulting the real wife and for a son without a qualm.
This note, incidentally, carries through all his books and how, until one comes under the influence of God, the other person isn't there and you aren't there. You neither know yourself nor do you know the next person. And so you're always dealing with each other under these masks. I mean, you're living an imaginary life towards yourself and an imaginary life with them. And the real meeting of person to person only occurs when God breaks through. This is a very real note in all of these books, incidentally.
There's really no relationship.
Yeah, it's simply something. Yeah.
Three. When two humans have lived together for many years, it usually happens that each has tones of voice and expressions of face that are almost unendurably irritating to the other. Work on that. Bring fully into the consciousness of your your patient that particular lift of his mother's eyebrows, which he learned to dislike in the nursery. Let him think how much he dislikes it. Let him assume that she knows how annoying it is, and does it to annoy. If you know your job, he will not notice the immense improbability of the assumption. And, of course, never let him suspect that he has tones and looks which somebody has not heard. As he cannot see or hear himself, this is easily managed. Or, in civilized life, domestic hatred usually expresses itself by saying things which would appear quite harmless on paper. The words are not offensive. But in such a voice, or at such a moment, that they are not far short of a blow in the face. To keep this game up, you and Glucose must see to it that each of these two fools has a sort of double standard. Your patient must demand that all his own utterances are to be taken at their face value and judged simply on the actual words, while at the same time judging all his mother's utterances with the fullest and most oversensitive interpretation of the tone and the context and the suspected intention.
You know, there's a wonderful thing by Gore Vidal in last week's New York Times on just this as a novelist. He says, I expect that every critic will judge me by what I intended to write. I expect to be able to judge anybody else by what he actually did.
She must be encouraged to do the same to him. Hence, from every quarrel, they can both go away convinced, or very nearly convinced, that they are quite innocent. You know the kind of thing. Quote, I simply ask her what time dinner will be, and she flies into a temper. End quote. Once this habit is well established, you have the delightful situation of a human saying things which the express purpose of, with the express purpose of offending, yet having a grievance when offense is taken. Finally, tell me something about the old lady's religious position. Is she at all jealous of the new factor in her son's life? At all piqued that he should have learned from others so late what she considers she gave him such a good opportunity of learning in childhood? Does she feel that he is making a great deal of fuss about it, or that he's getting in on very easy terms? Remember the elder brother in the story. Perfection.
Yeah, somebody else? We have plenty of time to read a couple more. They're short.
When we have
8:15. And we can even start a few minutes later or earlier, either way. But this is all we're going to have tonight in this, and this is the only time we'll be reading this. And it is fun to come back to it after years. I could have almost written that one chapter on the mother and the son. I remember it so well myself. Do you want to read, Dean?
Okay.
Right next to it.
My dear Wormwood, the amateur suggestions in your last letter warned me that it is high time for me to write to you fully on the painful subject of prayer. You might have spared the comment that my advice about the prayers for his mother proved singularly unfortunate. That is not the sort of thing that a nephew should write unto his uncle, nor a junior tempter to the undersecretary of a department. It also reveals an unpleasant desire to shift responsibility. You must learn to pay for your own blunders. The best thing, where it is possible, is to keep the patient from a serious intention of praying altogether. But when the patient is an adult recently reconverted to the enemy's party, like your man, this is best done by encouraging him to remember, or to think he remembers, the parrot-like nature of his prayers in childhood. In reaction against that, he may be persuaded to aim at something entirely spontaneous, inward, informal, and unregularized. And what this will actually mean to the beginner will be an effort to produce in himself a vaguely devotional mood in which real concentration of will and intelligence have no part. One of their poets, Coleridge, has recorded that he did not pray with moving lips and bended knees, but merely composed his spirit to love and indulge in a sense of supplication. That is exactly the sort of prayer we want. And since it bears a superficial resemblance to the prayer of silence as practiced by those who are very far advanced in the enemy's service, clever and lazy patients can be taken in by it for quite a long time. At the very least, they can be persuaded that the bodily position makes no difference to their prayers, for they constantly forget. What you must always remember, that they are animals, and that whatever their bodies do affects their souls. It is funny how mortals always picture us putting things into their minds. In reality, our best work is done by keeping things out. If this fails, you must fall back on the subtler misdirection of his intention. Whenever they are attending to the enemy himself, we are defeated. But there are ways of preventing them from doing so. The simplest is to turn their gaze away from him towards themselves. Keep them watching in their own minds and trying to produce feelings, thereby the action of their own wills.
You see the centrality of the gospel that's all the way through with these fellows. Turn their gaze away from him towards themselves. Go back under law. Go ahead.
When they meant to ask him for clarity, let them instead start trying to manufacture charitable feelings for themselves and not notice that this is what they are doing. When they meant to pray for courage, let them really be trying to feel brave. When they say they are praying for forgiveness, let them be trying to feel forgiven. Teach them to estimate the value of each prayer by their success in producing the desired feeling, and never let them suspect how much success or failure of that kind depends on whether they are well or ill, fresh or tired at the moment. But of course, the enemy will not meantime be idle. Whenever there is prayer, there is danger of his own immediate action. He is cynically indifferent to the dignity of his position and ours as pure spirits, and to the human animals on their knees he pours out self-knowledge in a quite shamefulest fashion. But even if he defeats your first attempt at misdirection, we have a subtler weapon. The humans do not start from that direct perception of him which we, unhappily, cannot avoid. They have never known that ghastly, luminously, that stabbing and searing glare which makes the background of permanent pain to our lives. If you look into the patient's mind when he is praying, you will not find that. If you examine the object to which he is attending, you will find that it is a composite object containing many quite ridiculous ingredients. There will be images derived from pictures of the enemy as he appeared during the discreditable episode known as the Incarnation. There will be vigor, perhaps quite savage and puerile. There will even be some of his own reverence and of bodily sensations accompanying it, objectified and attributed to the object revered. I have known cases where what the patient is called God was actually located up and to the left at the corner of the bedroom ceiling or inside his own head or in a crucifix on the wall. But whatever the nature of the composite object, you must keep him praying to it, to the thing that he is made, not to the person who has made him. You must even encourage him to attach great importance to the correction and to the improvement of his composite object, and to keeping it steadily before his imagination during the whole prayer. For if he ever comes to make the distinction, if he ever consciously directs his prayers, not to what I think thou art, but to what thou knowest thyself to be, our situation is, for the moment, desperate. Once all his thoughts and images have been flung aside, or, if retained with a full recognition of their merely subjective nature, and a man trusts himself to be completely real, external, invisible presence, there with him in the room, and never knowable by him as he is known by it. Why, then it is that the incalculable may occur. In avoiding this situation, this real nakedness of the soul of prayer, you will be helped by the fact that humans themselves do not desire it as much as they suppose. There's such a thing as getting more than they bargain for. Your affectionate uncle, Screwtape.
How many of you have read it before? All right, you see quite a few, about half or more. And having read this far, I think you will continue to. It is
It is a delight, really, in many ways. I think we'll just read this 1-5, and I'll read it here, and it introduces a new aspect, a new perspective, in which war is introduced, this idea, the evil of man. My dear Wormwood, it is a little bit disappointing to expect a detailed report on your work and to receive instead such a vague rhapsody as your last letter. You say you're delirious with joy because the European humans have started another of their wars. I see very well what has happened to you. You are not delirious, you are only drunk. Reading between the lines in your very unbalanced account of the patient's sleepless night, I can reconstruct your state of mind fairly accurately. For the first time in your career, you have tasted that wine which is the reward of all our labors, the anguish and bewilderment of a human soul, and it has gone to your head. I can hardly blame you. I do not expect old heads and young shoulders. Did the patient respond to some of your terror pictures of the future? Did you work in some good self-pitying glances at the happy past? Some fine thrills in the pit of his stomach were there? You played your violin prettily, did you? Well, well, it's all very natural. But do remember, Wormwood, that duty comes before pleasure. If any present self-indulgence on your part leads to the ultimate loss of the prey, you will be left eternally thirsting for that draught of which you are now so much enjoying your first sip. If on the other hand, by steady and cool-headed application here now, you can finally secure his soul, he will then be yours forever, a brimful living chalice of despair and horror and astonishment that you can raise your lips as often as you please. So do not allow any temporary excitement to distract you from the real business of undermining faith and preventing the formation of virtues. Give me without failure an next letter full account of the patient's reactions to the war, so we consider whether you are likely to do more good by making him an extreme patriot or an ardent pacifist. There are all sorts of possibilities. In the meantime, I must warn you not to hope too much from the war. Of course, a war is entertaining. The immediate fear and suffering of the humans is a legitimate and pleasing refreshment for our myriads of toiling workers. But what permanent good does it do us unless we make use of it for bringing souls to our Father below? When I see the temporal suffering of humans who finally escape us, I feel as if I'd been allowed to taste the first course of a rich banquet and then denied the rest. It is worse than not to have tasted it at all. The enemy, true to his barbarous methods of warfare, allows us to see the short misery of his favorites only to tantalize and torment us, to mock the incessant hunger which during this present phase of the great conflict, his blockade is admittedly imposing. Let us therefore think rather how to use than how to enjoy this European war, for it has certain tendencies inherent in it which are in themselves by no means in our favor. We may hope for a good deal of cruelty and unchastity, but if we are not careful, we shall see thousands turning in this tribulation to the enemy, while tens of thousands who do not go so far as that will nevertheless have their attention diverted from themselves to values and causes which they believe to be higher than the self. I know that the enemy disapproves many of these causes, but that is where he is so unfair. He often makes prizes of humans who have given their lives for causes he thinks bad, on the monstrously sophistical ground that the humans thought them good and were following the best they knew. Consider, too, what undesirable deaths occur in wartime. Men are killed in places where they knew they might be killed, into which they go if they are at all the enemy's party prepared. How much better for us all if humans died in costly nursing homes amid doctors who lie, nurses who lie, friends who lie, as we have trained them, promising life to the dying, encouraging the belief that sickness excuses every indulgence, and even if our workers know their job, withholding all suggestion of a priest